Well, I want to talk about writing for a minute, letter writing. That's kind of a lost art. The whole of our New Testament is filled with letters. Letters of Paul or Peter or James to individual groupings of people, individual churches scattered throughout the Roman Empire. They were written for very solid and specific purposes. But today, you know, we don't get the letter thing too much. We tweet. And instead of letters, we have Hallmark carding. So, you know, I said I'm going to get online this week, and I'm going to see the different kinds of cards that got sent out for Father's Day. Found it right? And besides, I'm the one up here, so I get to do that. All right. Father's Day card. So let's see the first one that's out there. I love how we don't even need to say out loud that I'm your favorite child. That's a good one. Next one up is a two-parter. This is one you open up. To the world's greatest father, thank you for always being there. And then you open it up, and it's, speaking of being there, can I have 500? Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, good. That's a son, not a daughter, I'm pretty sure. Next one up. Happy Father's Day to the only person on the planet still willing to employ me. That's good. That's good. I like that one. All right, next one up. Let's see. Grandpa. I had to find a grandpa one, right? The one you turn to when mommy and daddy both say no. I think there's a little message in there. Grandpas and grandmas, be careful what's going on there with those sweet little darlings come to you with wonderful smiles. Next one up. Oh, I like this one. The card reads, "You're sick and twisted and evil, but you're still our dad." And Leia says, "Look, it's perfect." I like that one. And the last one, I think, are we up to the last one? Yes, this is what I actually got sent by my eldest son. Before kids and after kids, and then he wrote in on the side, "Sorry," but the card didn't quite look like this either. The card really looked like this. He put beards on me. That's really cute. I took him out of the will. Once again. All right, Father's Day cards. Aren't they fun? All these kind of cards. Well, we're back to letters. Letters were what it was all about in the day of Paul. If you wanted to communicate with somebody, you sent them a letter. And the letters had great meaning, great purpose, great importance. When Paul wrote the letter to the church at Philippi, which we call Philippians, he was writing to a very specific group of people with very specific issues, needs, and in his case, Paul expressing his joy and his love for this particular church. Specifically, we have seen now, as we're entering into chapter 4, backing up, we have seen Paul warning this church about two groups of people. The first were false teachers, who claimed to be Christians, but they attempted to add to the gospel message. They said, yes, you accept Christ as your Lord and Savior, but it's not enough. You also need to follow all the dictates of the Jewish law. All right? So it was Christ plus works is what they were advocating, a works-based religion. Nothing's changed, at least from their viewpoint. Another group of people that Paul warns them against are people who are engaged in what we might call false living. And these people were tempting the church to concentrate more on the things of the world than the things of God and His kingdom. He says that they're all about their human appetites, their human drives. Their God, he uses very interesting language, their God is their belly or their God is their stomach. What he was saying there is they are captive to their human drives. The drives of the flesh, the fact that we live in a human body which is subject to all kinds of drives and impulses. And he said that's what they're all about, and they glory in their shame. They glory in the things that they should be ashamed about. So false teachers and then false livers. Now here's the third situation where Paul has to issue a warning to this church. It's an internal issue that could have proven very divisive to the fellowship, could have split it in half for all we know. Now, we're in the midst of a series called Building Blocks. We're going through this epistle, this letter of Paul to this church, and we're seeing what can we glean out of this that speaks to us today in the 21st century? What were the issues that that church was dealing with? And how then do we deal with those same issues according to Paul's instruction, according to the way God would want him to deal with them? Well, today we're looking at this issue called unity. And unity, when it's in full effect, it binds God's church together. A unity around purpose and perspective and view and values. It will bind God's church together and give it that laser-like focus that it needs to fully impact its world around them. The church today in America is drifting. We don't have a laser-like focus. We have many voices calling out. And the church is going here and there and everywhere. And what every individual local church needs to do is its homework. It needs to say, what does God have to say about whatever the issue is? Philippians chapter 4, verses 1 through 3 is our text today. I'll be reading from the New International Version. Paul, continuing the thought that he'd had from the previous chapter, says, therefore, my brothers, you whom I love and long for, my joy and crown, that is how you should stand firm in the Lord, dear friends. He's told them to stand firm, and he said, now that's what I want you to do. And then we have this very interesting section. I plead with Euodia, and I plead with Syntyche to agree with each other in the Lord. Yes, and I ask you, loyal yoke fellow, help these women who have contended at my side for the cause of the gospel, along with Clement and the rest of my fellow workers whose names are in the book of life. What's the problem? What is Paul addressing here? Well, number one, we might note that it is very, very seldom that Paul ever addresses anyone by name inside of his letters. Now, Paul followed the standards of letter writing of his day, and there was normally a greeting at the very beginning, and he would say who's writing the letter and who's with him and who is he writing to. And at the very end of his letter, he would also send greetings to people, and he would name a lot of names. Go to the end of the book of Romans. It is one name after another. Paul recognizing these people and saying, hey, here's a shout out to you. But it is very seldom that Paul mentions people's names in the body of his letter. But here he names two women, Euodia and Syntyche. And we have to find out why. What's going on here? Well, from what Paul wrote, we can determine a few things. Number one, to be mentioned at all means that these two women were leaders in the church. These weren't just people who came in and sat down and said nothing and did nothing in the church and walked out, and that was the sum part of their influence and effort inside that church body. These were women of influence. We just saw in that promo for the leadership summit, we all have influence, and we can choose to exercise our influence for good or for evil. What we know about these two women, or what we can suppose, is both of these ladies had great influence in the church. In fact, he's calling them fellow workers, and Paul doesn't give that title to too many people. So we believe they were key leaders in the church at Philippi. And the other thing we know is that they're involved in some sort of disagreement. We're not told what it is. We have no idea. But commentators speculate it's a lot more than they just didn't like each other's hairstyles. Okay? We're talking about issues of substance here that affect the church. And left unchecked, this church that Paul loves could slide into dissension and factions and disruption and maybe even split. So he says to them, literally, have the same mind with one another, which recalls what Paul has already said in the first chapter, verse 27, the latter part of verse 27, when he says that the church is to be standing firm in one spirit with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. Some commentators speculate that Paul, in stating this in the first chapter, was just leading up to what he's going to say in the fourth chapter. because he uses the same verbiage. Keep that verse back up there because I just want to look at the underlying part. With one mind, having the same mind, the same perspective on something. It's the exact same verbiage he uses here in chapter 4, urging these two women. Have the same mind, have the same perspective. It's possible, perhaps very possible, these two women were at odds over the way they needed to do church in the midst of a very challenging world. As I've just said, there were two groups that Paul warns them against. The group that said, literally, you're not legalistic enough. You don't follow the rules the way you should be following rules. Judaism provided them over 600 laws that needed to be lived out any given day. And they were saying, you need to be a rule keeper. You need to be doing all those things that we did for so many centuries. You're not legalistic enough. But the other group that Paul warns them against, they were saying, you're not free enough. You're not free enough. God's grace is wonderful. It's spectacular. It frees us up to do whatever. And the fact is, we're concentrating more on the spiritual than we are the physical anyway. So what you do with your body doesn't matter. And if you make a mistake, well, God's there to forgive you anyway, right? His grace is sufficient. Therefore, sin. Go out and have a good time. God will forgive you. That's kind of their approach. Well, to combat these false paths, Paul has repeatedly urged this church to be united around the mind and the heart of Jesus. They are to focus on his priorities and replicate and imitate his lifestyle. These women and the church overall needed to commit to a unified approach around Christ. Now, I'm not saying this was easy, but it looks like that's what Paul is telling them to do. Well, this got me to thinking. What about SCFBC? We're a church just like that church back in Philippi. And we are surrounded with a culture that has many different voices. Many different things are being said these days. Who are you going to listen to? Who are you going to believe? Which path are you going to take? These are the challenges for all of us. A few weeks ago, in the third of this series, I said that we first of all needed to humble ourselves. We need to humble ourselves in the sense that we have to set aside our own personal agendas. For everyone here has a personal agenda. I have one, you have one. And I'm talking about a selfish agenda. I'm talking about a self-serving agenda. We all have them. I mean, you know, us pastors, one of our agendas is, how big is your church? When I was younger, I could really get wrapped up into that one. I used to hate getting to pastors' meetings, because when you got together with a group of pastors, one of the questions that would always pop up, well, first they'd ask, well, how's your church doing? And everybody would say what? Wonderful, fine, glorious. You could be tearing each other's eyes out, but you wouldn't say that. And then another question that would float around and pop up at times, well, how big is your church? Oh, that's a really loaded question. Because what is going on there is the pastors are trying to establish a pecking order, and the one with the biggest congregation wins. The one with the biggest congregation is on top. And then we kind of line ourselves up going that way. I had to really fight that. It was very, very hard. We all have agendas, folks. We all have those things going on inside of our heads and our hearts saying, oh, I need this. I need this. I need you to do something for me. Okay? And you'd say the same thing. I need all of you around me to do something for me. We all have our agendas. And so 3 weeks, on the third week, I said, we got to set aside all those agendas, humbly come to the cross, and we have to say, like Christ came as a servant. He set aside his personal agenda. He gave up his life for us. That is setting aside your personal agenda to get nailed to a cross and to die for us. All right, so there's that part. But then let's take it a step further, because what Paul is saying here in this latter part of Philippians and what he's already stated, well, Philippians 2:2 really kind of sums it up. He says in Philippians 2:2, make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and of one mind. Again, this could have been a message to those two ladies that was all the way in chapter 2, all the way up. Let's unpack those real quick. The same mind. This has to do with truth and biblical perspectives and values. What do we value? What do we value? Do we value, for instance, just that we're in a church that gathers a great crowd? Is that good enough for us? Or do we value the fact that our community, the local paper calls Santa Clara First Baptist a pillar in our community? Do we value that? What do we value? What's important to us? Because whatever we truly value is what is going to drive our behavior. And so we have the values and we have the perspectives and we have biblical priorities. God has given us this word. He's the authority. He's given us a word which therefore has authority. And he says, this is my mind. This is my mindset. These are my perspectives. These are my values. These are my rules. This is the way we ought to be doing business in the kingdom of God. Let us have the same mind. Let us have the same love. Well, this is the love of Christ, of course. That Christ has loved us. We love because Christ first loved us. That's what John wrote in his first letter. We love because Christ, God, has first loved us. How full are we of the love of Christ? How much are we opening ourselves up to the love of Christ, which then changes us from the inside out, and we can have that incredible ability like those wonderful people in Charleston, South Carolina, when on that Friday, just a few days after loved ones had been gunned down in that Bible study, and these people had a chance to speak directly to the accused via video feed, and they all shared their hurt and their pain, and some of them said, we forgive you. That is the love of Christ. And it's astounding to see. Let us have the same love for one another in the world. Let's have the same spirit. This is a unity about the Holy Spirit, because we realize that each and every person here who is a follower of Jesus, well, we're all family here. We are together here. We have really, literally, a better, greater, stronger bond than our blood relations. Because this relationship that we have is going to go right on through death, in through the gates, those pearly gates into heaven. This is what unites us together. The unity of God's Spirit working in and through us. And the same purpose. Focused on the same goals. Moving toward the same ends. Paul says, I want you to be like-minded and having the same love and one in spirit and one in mind. It's interesting that we came to this part in the text what our church staff is doing right now is beginning to contemplate what this church's goal should be for the next ministry season. We're just beginning to work on that. You realize our church should have some goals that it's working on? And I'll be the first to say I've been a lousy publicizer of our church goals. You probably don't even know what they are. Well, I'm here to tell you. We start out with a mission statement. And this is our current mission statement. And we might revise it slightly. But let's put it up on the screen and let's read it out loud together. The mission of Santa Clara First Baptist Church is to make disciples of Jesus Christ who love God, like God, serve God, and help others become Jesus followers. Now, every church that's serious about the gospel would have a mission statement like this. This is not unique to us in any way, shape, or form, because Jesus in the Great Commission said, go into the world and make disciples of all nations. We're about the business of leading people to Jesus Christ and helping them become maturing followers or disciples. That's our business. Now, how we live this out? Well, in our guiding principles, we talk about three ministry principles or directions. We say, number one, that we're a sharing church. We're a sharing church. And what do we share? We share the good news of the gospel. That's what we share. Into a dark and dying world, we share the good news that there is a God who is personal, and a God who cares, and a God who has demonstrated his power and his love by sending his son to die on a cross. To take care of business inside of us, to deal with that sense of failure and remorse and guilt and alienation that we struggle with. God says, I love you and I want you to be a part of my family. Would you accept my gift? That's what the gospel is. It's good news. It's good news in a world filled with bad news. And it is, I believe, the only thing that can truly change this world. We see ups and downs. We see this and that going on in societies. We see, you know, different people get elected to different jobs. We see regime change. But if you want disillusionment, just go to the Middle East, where gazillions of dollars and countless lives have been spent by America to fix things, and they're not fixed. Because what's got to get fixed is right here. Right here. And there's only one way to get us fixed, and that's Jesus. We share good news that we can get fixed by a loving God who can help us, relieve us of the guilt and the shame and the alienation, and bring us home and give us the power to change, to become the person that we really want to be. And so, because we're a sharing church, we're going to desire to get the word out and have more people come. We want to fill the airwaves with our voices and share with our friends and our neighbors and our relatives and every other person who walks through our doors, good news. Good news. We want to increase the number of people who are accepting Christ and being baptized. And we want more and more of us to be engaged in that process. Those are two of our goals for this ministry season. Increase the number of people accepting Christ. Increase the number of people involved in sharing and influencing people to come to Christ. You all have a shot at this. We want you. We need you. When we have a Sunday grill, it's a wonderful opportunity for those who are new. If you just walked in today and it's your first time, best burger in town. Well, it's been prayed over. Let's just say that. The most spiritual burger in town. Now with pickles. And over there. Yes, yes. Great chance to get to know people. We need people to man the grill. You say, can I flip a burger or can I burn a hot dog? Well, you're in. But we have a July 4th thing coming down too. Where people, we don't have to invite anybody. They show up on our lawn. They park in our lots. A few years ago, I was driving by. I had no idea what was going on. And well, I'm the pastor of the church, but clueless. I just work here. And I noticed, I was just driving by one 4th of July, and they were having the fireworks over at the park. And people were sitting on our lawn. People were parking in our parking lots. And I went, what is this? And I considered getting out a whip and driving these pagans away. And then God said, why don't you welcome them? Ooh. And so now, for our fourth year maybe, I don't know, been doing this 4 years, we help people park in our lots. We cram our lots as full as we can make them, and we don't charge. This is free parking. And we welcome people to sit on our lawn, and we hand out water, and we hand out popcorn, and we hand out, last year, glow sticks. Ooh. Kids love those things. And we give it all away. Because we're here to give the gospel away, and it's free. So why don't we just show forth what that looks like? But it takes people to do this, doesn't it? And you, we need you to sign up. Take an hour out of your time and hand out popcorn. It's so much fun to give stuff away. I don't know if you've had that experience, but it's a gas, man. And people say, well, how much? And we say, it's free. They go, oh. Some people are passing by on the sidewalk because people park wherever, and they're just walking down the street, and we just go out and hand stuff to them, and they go, and they may the first they just kind of no, and then we say it's free, and they go oh, and they come back. They can't believe somebody's giving something away. But that's the gospel in action. We need you to influence more people with the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Amen? Second principle, growing. We are a growing church. We want to grow in terms of how many people are coming together on a Sunday morning to worship and love God. This is where we learn how to love God. This is our all-together time when we are exposed to the good news of the gospel. We hear His word. We sing His praises. It's to touch our hearts as well as our minds. And we're to just grow in our love for this magnificent God that we worship. And we also want to grow in our own personal discipleship. And we want to grow in our love for others. And we do that in small groups. Our life group ministry is a key player in this. Not the whole thing, but it's key. When you get people in small groups, they get to know each other. They get to love each other. And they hear the word, and they grapple with the word, and they grow. And that's what it's all about. We want to grow in numbers and in our understanding of what it means to follow Christ. And thirdly, we're a serving church. And you kind of get this one already. If you've been around here any length of time, you know we talk a lot about that. But this is the third step. We got to grow in our love for God. We got to grow in our love for others. And then we can grow strongly in this concept of serving others in the world and in the church itself. And that's what we need to do. You've seen the towels. What's it say on the towels? Here to serve. We kind of highlight the last one of those three because we want to say, you know, how do you know you're a maturing Christian? How do you know you're getting somewhere? How do you know that you're not an infant anymore or infantile or selfish and self-centered? How do you know? When you start serving. When you get out of yourself and into helping other people. That's how you know you're growing, is when you get out of yourself. And so this is one we highlight for that reason. Now, I want to end this time together by welcoming new members. You know who you are. Come on up. Come on up. This is kind of fun. Those who are new members to our church, well, these are people who've said, I want to commit myself to the goals that your church has. I want to say, count me in. I want to say, you can count on me. Because commitments are what drives growth. Okay? If you're not committed to anything, you're not growing. But as I know, after 38 years of marriage, you commit yourself to one woman, and you have to grow. Because I found out how selfish and self-centered I am, and I didn't know that before I got married. I thought I was a wonderful person. But when she says, honey, can you help me with the dishes? And I'm sitting reading something on my laptop of great importance, and I have to get off my keister and help my wife. I have to die a little to myself, don't I? Yeah.